Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with 15 Democratic U.S. senators signing on to a hardline bill that would scuttle the initiative underway with Iran to curb its nuclear program. Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist and author of the new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, joins us to analyze the influence of Israel in determining U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and the lack of an anti-war lobby in Washington to counterbalance the hawks on Capitol Hill bent on closing the door on Obama's tentative moves towards peace. Then we will speak with Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and a contributing editor to The Nation. We will discuss a new poll from the left-leaning public policy polling that indicates Republicans might pay a price for cutting unemployment benefits on December the 28th, since voters overwhelmingly support extending benefits, with a majority of fair-minded Americans apparently understanding the unemployed want to work and should not be punished for the economic downturn caused by Wall Street. Then finally, we'll look into the possibility that a new threat of war from North Korea is likely to erupt soon as the new young leader, Kim Jong-un, who has just executed his uncle, the number two in the regime, moves to assert his dynastic rule over the impoverished, nuclear-armed and militarized failed state. Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of International Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss a new round of nuclear brinksmanship looming on the Korean Peninsula. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His new book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you, Ian.
And we just learned today that 15 Democratic senators have signed on to a Republican bill that has 19 Republican co-sponsors. Oh, I suppose it's a Senate bill that's taking a very hard line, levying new sanctions on Iran unless the Iranian leaders agree to abandon all uranium enrichment. The Secretary of State has warned that this will scatter the deal, as has Mohammed El-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has also said that if the Senate moves forward on this bill, the deal that they're now negotiating would be dead. So what's your understanding, Max Blumenthal, of why these Democratic senators are taking this stance?
They're taking this stance because they are responding to the interests and concerns of wealthy donors affiliated with AIPAC, the American-Israel Policy Action Conference, which is the largest and most powerful arm of the pro-Israel lobby. It acts on behalf of the Israeli government. It is now acting on behalf of the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been agitating for a U.S. attack on Iran since he came into office in 2009, mainly because Israel doesn't have the military capacity to carry out such an attack and doesn't have the political cover to do so. And he's even attempted to unseat President Barack Obama through the millions of Sheldon Adelson, who is one of Netanyahu's key funders, also one of the key funders of AIPAC, and was the top funder of Mitt Romney when he attempted to challenge Barack Obama for the presidency. Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, even wrote a letter accusing Netanyahu of attempting to interfere in American politics. Having failed to overthrow Barack Obama, Netanyahu has had to pay the price of a historic deal between Iran and the U.S. on rapprochement over Iran's nuclear program, which Israeli intelligence estimates cannot even confirm has a weaponized capacity. So Netanyahu and his government are working through AIPAC, through their cutouts in Washington, to scuttle this deal. And they are working through Senator Robert Menendez, the Democrat who is the chief tool of AIPAC, the New Jersey Democratic senator. He's received the fourth largest amount of funding from AIPAC. And they're working through him rather than Mark Kirk, who is the chief Republican tool, the senator from Illinois of AIPAC, because this is a Democratic going to have to be a Democratic initiative. They have 15 senators. All of them are major recipients of AIPAC, or very dependent on AIPAC-affiliated donors for their careers, and many of them operate in hold seats in swing states. So they're always in a perilous position, and they need this money. And the deal is much more severe than you characterized it in the beginning, because it will require the U.S. Sorry, the bill, this resolution in the Senate, will require the U.S. to back up any Israeli military assault on Iran. It will lock the U.S. into attacking Iran if Israel strikes. So it's basically a call for war. It's not just a call for scuttling the deal. It's a call for war.
Well, indeed, that is apparently what senior Obama administration officials are saying. Quoting them, it's far more likely that we'll be left with only the military option regarding Iran. You're saying it's actually in the bill itself, locking in the military option.
Let me. The bill is called the Nuclear Weapons Free Act, Iran Act of 2013. They can't call it the Nuclear Weapons Free Act of 2013 because Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, but the state of Israel has 250 nuclear-tipped warheads and second strike capacity through Dolphin-class submarines provided to it by Germany as part of Germany's Holocaust reparations. Those submarines have launching tubes that are specially retrofitted to allow Israel to fire nuclear weapons from the Red Sea. The new resolution that we're talking about would completely violate the deal that was cut in Geneva between Washington and Tehran. And it would set up a scenario in which hardliners would be empowered in Iran again. Ahmadinejad's camp would be empowered, which is actually the wet dream of Israel and AIPAC. AIPAC has consistently supported Ahmadinejad when he's run for president. They've even issued letters along with other pro-Israel hardliners like Daniel Pipes declaring that Ahmadinejad would be a better figure to have in power than someone like Rouhani, because both are going to pursue a nuclear program, but Ahmadinejad's easier to demonize in the media, and therefore it's easier to get sanctions against him. But the bill also has language in it, and you can look up the language that calls for the U.S. to support Israeli, quote-unquote, military action and legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapons program. It declares that the U.S. should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with the law of the United States, blah, 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 to authorize the use of military force, military and economic support to the government of Israel in its defense of its territory, people, and existence. That language was introduced in February by Lindsey Graham in another resolution that has kind of been, and it's been packaged into this resolution. And it was actually passed already by the Senate in April. So they're basically ratifying another non-binding resolution that was passed into a much stronger and more consequential pro-war resolution.
Again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. So how much is this being driven by AIPAC and by extension Netanyahu in Israel, or by this sort of reflexive loathing Republicans have for Obama?
Well, I think that there's a ricochet effect in the Republican Party, but this is an initiative of AIPAC, which is the key arm of the Israeli government in Washington. So the pro-war lobby is actually the Israeli lobby. This would be, if this bill passes, it would be a bill to declare war for Israel against the wishes of the American public. And what we need to recognize is that as strong as AIPAC is, and that they do have these 15 powerful Democrats advancing a pro-war bill on behalf of the Israeli government in Washington, to that they're significantly weakened, and that they've been weakened in the past year. They were weakened by the Syria vote that never happened, which was so unpopular in Congress. AIPAC was forced to come out in support of a military attack on Syria, and the bill was so unpopular that it never came to a vote. And now they are facing another situation in which the Democratic Party is split on one of their key resolutions. The Democratic Party in Congress is being asked to come out against the Obama administration. And the Democratic grassroots is completely dead set against this bill and against going to war for Israel against Iran. I wouldn't be on this program if that wasn't the case. AIPAC's biggest nightmare is that pro-Israel support becomes Republicanized. And that's what's happening with these kind of resolutions, as they've been exposed as acting against popular opinion in the U.S. and especially against popular opinion in the Democratic Party. We now have 10 Democratic committee chairs in the Senate who are opposed to this bill, including Carl Levin and Dianne Feinstein. These are not exactly, you know, anti-Israel zealots. These are people who take hundreds of thousands of dollars from AIPAC, you know, every 6 years. And they're just recognizing that their constituents are totally against it. Well, if you look inside AIPAC and you look at who's running it, you're increasingly seeing Republican neoconservatives staffing AIPAC. You're seeing Republican neoconservatives taking the lead in the pro-Israel lobby inside the U.S. And if you look at opinion polls among Democrats and the Democratic grassroots of the U.S.'s special relationship with Israel, it's increasingly very negative. And the more educated people are, the higher of an education level they have, the more opposed they are to the special relationship. The more progressive they are, the more opposed they are to the special relationship. So we're actually seeing a crisis play out for the Israel lobby in Washington. And the more exposure this bill gets, the deeper the crisis becomes.
Let me just read quickly the list of these 15 Democratic senators who appear to be willing to risk war with Iran rather than let the White House and Iranian leaders continue with the negotiations that they've agreed upon. You've got Senate Robert Menendez of New Jersey, the bill sponsor, Senator Mark Begich of Alaska, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Senator Kay Hagan of North Carolina, Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas, and Senator Charles Schumer of New York, and Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. So what's the chances then of that group, along with the 19 Republicans, getting a majority here? They're obviously short of a majority.
Yeah, I don't know what the chances are, but I do think that AIPAC is a little bit shocked that they've failed to gather more Democratic support for this, and that more Democrats will fall away under intense White House lobbying, because the White House has openly come out and declared that this is not a bill that they want. The White House has said that it's impossible to expect Iran to cease all nuclear enrichment. Barack Obama said, you know, I'd like to get all my bills passed by Congress, but that's impossible too. And Barack Obama said the American people are sick of this march to war, and he's right. So the White House can do a lot to prevent this vote from passing in the Senate. And, of course, you're right. There are Republicans who simply would like to undermine the Obama administration and will vote for this anyway. But the key force here is AIPAC, and it's people like Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer, who said that it makes sense to strangle the Gaza Strip economically. Chuck Schumer, who recently at an event in New York, a gathering of Orthodox Jews, declared that he would vow to defeat the Arab world and the Palestinians. He said, he used that actual language, and he railed against the Obama administration's deal. He's basically declared war against the Obama administration. Chuck Schumer, this bigoted zealot, has declared open war with the Obama administration. So we're seeing battle within the Democratic Party, and the issue will also come down to grassroots lobbying. There are groups like There are a coalition of progressive groups that have lobbied successfully for the deal between the U.S. and Iran. And these groups have a lot of power within the party and at a local level to make an impact. And I think, you know, with someone like Dianne Feinstein coming out against it, clearly they're listening to their constituents, their Democratic constituents, who are disgusted with this march to war.
Well, my understanding, though, is that this is – I don't recall this ever happening before when a country's in negotiations with a longstanding enemy, that you would be trying to scuttle the negotiations before they really get started. And for example, during the Cold War, you know, if the U.S. and the Soviet Union were ever to get together, I know there were the various Jackson-Evanick amendments and others that tried to scuttle SALT I and SALT II, but the overwhelming force of public opinion has always been that it's better to try and end these disputes, you know, and this one with Iran's gone on for, what, 33, almost 34 years. What you're telling us, Max Blumenthal, is that what AIPAC's up against and what Netanyahu's up against is American war weariness, public opinion, and in general, I imagine, you know, the American people basically are sick of wars and sick of their involvement in the Middle East, which is obviously of late been a catastrophe with Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, it's a pretty hard thing to sell that kind of war after what's just happened and what just happened with Syria as well. So I suppose in the broader sense, they're railing against the march of history here, right?
Well, and, you know, what's unique is that when the U.S. engaged in negotiations with the Soviet Union, it didn't have to send its chief negotiator to a third country to vet the negotiations before it could do so, which it recently did with Wendy Sherman, sending her to Israel to first get the approval of the foreign government of a country that's smaller than the state of New Jersey to carry out these historic negotiations. So there's no way that any of these senators or any of the people who favor this resolution, this pro-war resolution, can sell the bill in terms of American national interest. And that's the problem. You had, during the march to war on Iraq, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and people running cover for the neocons, selling the war on Iraq under the guise of American national interest, with the idea of terror attacks on the U.S., mushroom cloud, an imminent mushroom cloud looming if we allow Saddam Hussein to stay in power. There's really no way to sell Americans on the idea that Iran presents an imminent nuclear threat to the United States. Americans really aren't buying it except among the, you know, low information realms of the Tea Party. And so that's the key problem for AIPAC. And AIPAC, as Steve Rosen, the former AIPAC staffer, said, thrives like a night flower under the cover of darkness. And when it's exposed in the light, the night flower dies. The night flower is being exposed now as the only major lobbying force pushing for a war for the interests of the right-wing government of Israel against American popular opinion and against the will of a rapidly shifting Democratic Party. So even if this resolution passes, the process by which it passed does not bode well for the Israel lobby or for the march to war with Iran. And I think there is a chance that it could be defeated, but it's going to require more grassroots pressure on Democratic senators.
Well, just in closing, Max Blumenthal, it's pretty clear that Netanyahu has contempt for President Obama. And at the time when Obama backed away from a war with Syria over them crossing the red line on chemical weapons, there was open contempt expressed by Netanyahu and some of his officials that basically Obama chickened out and didn't have the backbone, etc. But what Obama did manage to do, along with the Russians, or what Kerry did too, is to remove a real threat from Israel, which is the threat of chemical weapons on various warheads that are aimed at them from both Hezbollah and Syria. That's something that deeply concerns the Israeli public. So you've just written this book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and spent some time there, obviously, writing it. What is this? Is there any sense in the Israeli, amongst the population, that actually Obama, in spite of what their prime minister says about him, has actually managed to negotiate a deal that removes a terrible threat from Israel?
The threat to Israel, and I think, you know, the state planners and military intelligence apparatus know this, that the threat to Israel does not come from chemical weapons or little homemade rockets from Hamas. It comes from democracy. Israel is a Jewish state that's predicated on the ethnic privilege of Jews over all indigenous Palestinians. And the abrogation of Palestinian rights is central to the state's existence. And so the threat of democracy or providing equal rights to Palestinians is the greatest threat. And by hyping up the Iran threat, Netanyahu is able to distract from the Palestinian situation. And by complaining and crying and forcing Obama to play the babysitter over the Iran deal, the U.S. has to do something to mollify Netanyahu. And if you look at the details of Kerry's plan for a Palestinian quasi-state in the West Bank, which would be a series of Bantustans, you can see in it that they've taken all of the details that Israel has offered and just implemented them under the guise of a U.S. plan. They have to give Israel something. And so they've basically given Netanyahu the West Bank to mollify him over this deal. The other factor is that the majority of the Jewish Israeli public joins Netanyahu in his loathing of Barack Obama. They see Obama as potentially a crypto-Muslim anti-Semite who hates Israel, despite all that he's given to Israel. And so the majority of the Jewish Israeli public recently declared in an Israel Democracy Institute poll that they favor finding new allies in the Obama era and ending the special relationship. I think that would be a great idea, by the way. The problem is that 70% of them also say that it would be impossible to find any. But if you look at the kind of people that Israel's courting around the world, you can see an attempt to find allies who do share values with this state. For example, the Israeli ambassador recently met with the head of the neo-fascist Svoboda Party in the Ukraine, which is actually led by people who express anti-Semitic opinions. The Israeli ambassador has also met with Moti, the Indian Hindu ultranationalist who stoked deadly anti-Muslim riots, who's been denounced by the State Department, and who's expressed sympathy for Adolf Hitler. The Israeli government the Israeli Foreign Minister, Avigdor Lieberman, recently welcomed Geert Wilders, who is one of the most powerful politicians in the Netherlands and the leading Islamophobe in the world in Israel. He's visited Israel over 40 times. And then you have Israel courting the Christian Zionists in the U.S., people like Pastor John Hagee, the head of Christians United for Israel, the group that was set up by AIPAC to push for a war on Iran and to bring Israel support to its natural home in the right wing of the Republican Party. This is the same John Hagee who declared that the Antichrist was gay and partially Jewish, as was Adolf Hitler. This is an anti-Semitic figure. So well, Israel is...
This is a pretty depressing litany here, Max Blumenthal. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His new book just out is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether or not the Republicans will pay a price for cutting unemployment benefits.
this crazy town. Having a hard time, there's no love to be found. Having a hard time in this crazy town. Having a hard time, there's no love to be found. So many
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And Tom, the left-leaning public policy polling surveyed voters in four key congressional districts, including House Speaker John Boehner's in Ohio, to look at support for extending unemployment benefits. And they find that about 75%, 68% of voters in each district.
2-1 in favor of continuing, you know, benefits.
So what's the where's the disconnect here? If you got the public feeling that this is a cruel and unnecessary punishment,
Ian, well, look, I mean, this. How many times have we been here? I mean, that is to say, look, most of the stuff pushed by, especially Republicans, is not that popular. A lot of the stuff pushed by Democrats is not much more popular. But on this stuff, cutting unemployment benefits. You know, it's like, frankly, the idea of cutting Social Security, only, as Elizabeth Warren said very nicely about Social Security, only in Washington is there any demand to cut Social Security. And we might add New York, or New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago in the business districts, perhaps. But, you know, this is pretty much the same story here. This is something that the rest of the population, two-thirds of it, you know, simply abominates. I think that's clear. And, you know, the sample's a little small on these polls, 500 or 600 people in each district. But, hey, you know, when you get results like that, and the question looks like a pretty decent one, I think you can be reasonably confident that, yeah, something like 2-1, by 2-1 majorities, most of the American population thinks the idea of cutting off unemployment benefits, especially around Christmas, is simply a horrible idea.
And do you think that this will sort of blunt the Republican attack on the poor? You know, they've cut the food stamps recently, you know?
Yeah, the question is whether anybody will follow it up on the Democratic side. This is always the problem. You know, I mean, Obama, for example, instead of going off to Hawaii, could give a radio or even, I dare say, a TV address on this point. You know, I mean, geez, if you're going to have people, you know, getting paid to read Christmas Carol to audiences around the place, why not have the president read Christmas Carol to the whole population? And, you know, talk about, you know, why we shouldn't cut off unemployment benefits. Now, instead, he's gone off to Hawaii, and the Senate and the House are adjourning. Let's see if they come back. I mean, the one distressing thing about this to me is that it has to come out of what is some kind of Democratic group on Americans United for Change. You know, why doesn't the official Democratic Party actually say something about this and do something about it? But apart from that, if you like, caveat, I don't quarrel with the basic line of analysis, which says, you know, it's unpopular. Yes, people probably, if you remind them near the time they go in to vote, that their representative voted against continuing the benefits, then I think they likely will. It'll cost some of these guys. It's about time. You know, but they basically, we don't hear very many arguments in American public life. Mostly we hear the idiot stuff on Crossfire or on TV, you know, which no person with a three-digit IQ, I think, could listen to for more than about 2 minutes before you just want to say, ah, enough already. But, yeah, I mean, this is what, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, but it's exactly like the Social Security case, where, you know, you get this endless drumfire of cut coming from, you know, you name it, newspapers, TV, radio, talking heads of every stripe. And, you know, nobody in the United States, insignificant minorities want to do it.
And we're talking about, just in terms of our fellow Americans, 1.3 million Americans will be cut off the unemployment rolls on December the 28th. And a few months later, another 1.9 will be cut. And it appears that the American public don't consider this the right kind of treatment to their fellow Americans, who, after all, are victims of an economic collapse that was entirely to do with Wall Street's excesses.
That's right. And then an insufficient, you know, stimulus coming on behalf of the Democrats. Of course, no stimulus coming from the Republicans at all there. And, you know, telling people to go out and find work when aggregate demand is way down, when there's insufficient demand out there, that's just, you know, that's a mug's game. It's both stupid and mean.
So I'm wondering here, for example, I mean, so much of what's happening seems so unnecessary to punish these people who are looking for work. When you're talking about what a chump change in compared to the federal budget, I mean, it's just it's infinitesimal what the funds that they're talking about. And I've also been covering the bankruptcy of Detroit, which is entirely unnecessary. It's just because this partisan Republican governor decided to punish this city that's largely Democratic for making this crooked mayor and his business guy made all these crooked deals with the banks, with the these convoluted swaps and derivatives before the crash.
Derivatives are a big chunk of the story.
You never hear about that. And guess what? The bankruptcy judge just the other day called a halt to it because the same city that made all these squirrely deals, and by the way, the guy that made the deals ended up working for one of the banks, and the other guy, the mayor, is in jail. The judge says, wait a minute, you're offering the banks who got you into this hole 82 cents on the dollar, and you're offering the pensioners 16 cents on the dollar. I mean, it's extraordinary what's going on in this country.
I can only agree. Surely I cannot be expected to disagree with you. I don't mind making a plug for you. You folks, you know, are not corporate media. So you can hear that story on you. Yes, that you cannot hear that in the rest of the United States. That's plain as day. And you can't read it very easily either. I remember when the Detroit bankruptcy happened, the story about the derivatives came out, as I recall, on a Friday afternoon. It made it into the Financial Times on a small page where I happened to see it. And then I started passing it around to people in both New York and Washington. And since then, people have been making some noise. It's Christmas, so I'm doing my best to be happy, but
Well, you talked to the wrong guy, Tom.
I mean, you know, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie. This is not a whole lot to be super happy about in America in 2013. I mean, it's disgraceful. I mean, most of the way public policy is conducted, you know, the folks rolling in cash in Washington, every time I turn around, some new scheme for getting money into politics is happening. Yeah, look, it's what can I say? If you want people to cheer you up, you need a comedian. I'm not up to the task, especially toward the end of December. You know, I'm not claiming I have seasonal affective disorder, but I'm not living in Southern California. Okay, I'm living in New England, and that the sun goes down, it stays down. We hardly see it. It's sort of a memory. It's dark all the time. I mean, afraid the mood.
Right, but your politics are good. You got Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, yes. I mean, I somebody pointed, there was a congressman said that gave a little speech. I went to a funeral yesterday for Jerome Grossman, who was a really great American, the guy who largely responsible for the nuclear freeze and the Council for the Livable World, and somebody piped up there, well, hey, you know, I was elected for the first time in Congress in the McGovern landslide. That was, of course, the year the only state he took was in Massachusetts back in 72. Yes. Yeah, we are somewhat different from the rest of the United States. Not different enough, unfortunately, to escape most of the disastrous consequences. And if you're unemployed in Massachusetts and you lose your benefits, it's not going to be very consoling.
So, Tom Ferguson, just in the last few minutes here, let's talk about the broader theme, which was really inherent in what we're talking about, and that is income inequality. And you know about this sort of spat between the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, the Third Way group, and the progressive wing.
Yep. Now, look, here's what you want to pay attention to that discussion. That was interesting. I agree. I mean, which followed Elizabeth Warren's demands that the banks actually declare their donations, because they're not legally contributions to public policy think tanks in Washington. I mean, that was part of the same controversy there. Yes, but what you want to watch there is the way the Center for American Progress then jumped to defend the idea of talking about inequality. Then the next step was Podesta went into the White House. As he did it, there were articles saying, well, he was not only going into the White House to advise Obama, who, of course, had already made income inequality somewhat lately a theme, and I compared it actually a few days after he did it to St. Augustine's Lord Make Me Pure, but not yet. I mean, because he's, after all, he's been in president for quite some time now. A little late to get onto that theme. But then it turns out that Podesta is also supposed to be advising Hillary Clinton on her use of this theme. So my suggestion is everybody look hard at the use of the Democrats' discussion of inequality. And I welcome any discussion of this in public. We are way overdue for this discussion. But, you know, let's see if anybody comes up with any sort of serious proposals to do something about it. Simply talking about the problem makes me, you know, I'm from Missouri on this one, not Massachusetts. Show me.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, just in the last couple of minutes then, do you think that just as we were saying from the beginning of this conversation, that the public are sympathetic to the unemployed and are not in favor of this cruel and unusual punishment and cutting off unemployment benefits just around Christmas and following having cut food stamps for the poor, the disconnect between the political class in Washington and the average American, does it also apply to the issue of income inequality?
I think for sure. I mean, you could see that when the Third Way folks, they didn't want to discuss it at all. Then there was a variety of people, other voices coming in as a kind of cacophony. So, well, you know, it's not really inequality, it's something else. No, people are really disgusted when they have to listen to get lectured to by some billionaire who got, I mean, most of these folks who have made billions, not, you know, there may be one or two someplace, but many who have done this have, in fact, one way or the other, done it in the financial sector where the government subsidies to banks are huge. They've done it in telecommunications where government regulation has made the large cable companies incredibly rich. They have done it in high tech where, you know, 50 years or more of government investment has created a huge backlog of stuff that you can exploit. I mean, that's sort of like the hidden in the medical sphere. In pharmaceuticals, you just go down to the National Institute of Health and try to get close to researchers down there who are on government money trying to getting near some breakthrough in pharmaceuticals. Then you try to snark it. I mean, an enormous amount of you know, billionaires making money in the United States is very clearly dependent on public prior public investment. And, you know, then to turn around to people and complain, no, they don't want to pay taxes, and they're opposed to government expenditures, even let's cut unemployment benefits, it's too much. I do actually think a very large chunk of the public are utterly sick of this particular game. I think rather more than most people care to admit in public, in most of the mass media.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you have a very Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas to you too, Ian. I mean, well, let's everybody do our best, despite it all.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, the Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the possibility of a new threat of war on the Korean Peninsula. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And I believe you've just been in South Korea, and I understand that the South Korean intelligence agency have just come out with perhaps this comes from a leak of a parliamentarian who was briefed by the South Korean intelligence service, who, by the way, did release the information that that the uncle of the new leader Kim Jong-un had fallen from grace. Before the North Koreans had made the announcement, they're saying that this is all about a business-related dispute that Jang apparently refused an order from Kim to solve this dispute. Is that possibly what's behind his execution?
Well, the South Korean chief spy agency, when it announced Chang Sung-taek's purge early this month, December 3rd, it proved its viability, its raison d'etre to the South Korean people and to the world, because its assessment proved to be true, despite many charges of conspiracy theory, even from South Korea's left, and a lot of skepticism. So, yes, South Korean spy agency's announcement is to be taken quite seriously. Now, on the fine matter of whether this was a political purge with the primary purpose of eliminating Uncle Chang, who Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, saw as a prime threat to himself, or whether this dismissal and swift execution of Uncle Chang was the result of some financial bickering or conflicting interests related to financial matters, I think the difference is not all that telling, because when you consider the absolutely theatrical, cruel manner in which Uncle Jang, the number two man in North Korean politics for so long, when this execution was so swiftly executed, if you will, you have to draw the conclusion that Kim Jong-un wanted to make a point. And in any purge, there is the secondary purpose of that theatrical, dramatic, demonstrative effect, instilling fear in all others who would harbor illusions of building a power base. So I think Uncle Jang probably stepped over the line and came across to the top leader as a potential threat, and that's the primary reason that he was executed.
But didn't what happened, though, undermine the whole mystique of this divine rule of this dynastic family, almost, you know, infallible, like the Pope is supposed to be, the idea that they've revealed disharmony in the very top family?
Absolutely, you're right. You know, whatever the future fate of the man on top, in a totalitarian system, the life of the number two man is often short and precarious. So the fact that the number two man was abruptly dismissed like this comes as no surprise. At the same time, North Korea did something unwittingly, something unprecedented in actually kindly explaining to the world why the state went after Chung Sung-taek in such a manner and killed him off, even talking of a plot for a coup d'etat, and that unwittingly reveals chinks in the North Korean armor. As you say, the North Korean leadership is viewed as a deity. He is infallible. He is almost omnipotent. And I think the brash manner in which Kim Jong-un resolved this issue, if you will, reveals at the very least that Kim Jong-un feels confident, he is brash, he is impetuous, and perhaps prone to making miscalculation in the future, whether it's on managing court intrigue or foreign policy, because now he feels emboldened. He probably inhabits a virtual reality in which he is semi-divine and infallible, and that is a recipe for a serious mistake down the road.
Again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Well, that's the part that concerns me, and that's one of the reasons I was calling you, was because quite often the way that dictators solve, not that this public opinion has any voice or any power in North Korea, but still the idea that that he's shaken the regime and terrified everybody under him, that makes perfect sense. But another tool often used is to distract people from failures at home by adventures abroad. And they periodically make these threats of war. So there are two. That's the first question. Why don't you address that one? Because is it likely that he is now going to strike out if he's either delusional about his divine rule, or he feels the need to consolidate his power further?
Well, Kim Jong-un does have a lot to prove. Like many unqualified inheritors of great fortune and power, Kim Jong-un is terribly spoiled. His grandfather, the founder of the North Korean state, had actually been an anti-Japanese resistance guerrilla in the 1930s and 40s. So Kim, the founder of the dynasty, brought some revolutionary credentials to the table. And his late father, who died 2 years ago, although he was a princeling himself, nonetheless, he had had 20 years of apprenticeship under his own father, Kim Il-sung. So Kim Jong-un was thrust into this position in the wake of his father suffering a stroke in August 2008 and his eventual death in late 2011. So he has a lot to prove. He's inexperienced. He is young. I think there is a good chance that Kim Jong-un would lash out at South Korea in early part of 2014, but not necessarily because of this political purge, but because that's been the pattern: controlled, limited attacks against South Korea and provocations in the form of weapons tests. Over the past dozen years, there are some exceptions when North Korea lashed out in the second half of the calendar year, notably when it conducted its first nuclear test in 2006, and also when it shelled a South Korean inhabited island in 2010, and also last year when North Korea conducted a long-range missile test in mid-December. But those were banner years when Kim Jong-un was being beefed up as the next leader, and 2012 was also a banner year. It marked the 100th anniversary of the founder of the dynasty. So my point is, it's been North Korea's strategy to raise the stakes, remind the world, its more powerful neighbors in the region, that it is a political factor to be taken seriously, and the primary way to do that is to cause trouble, and then try to return to negotiations and reap concessions. So I think that likelihood is quite high.
So what do you make then of the fact that the uncle who Kim Jong-un executed and publicly humiliated before he executed him, and revealed, as you said, perhaps unwittingly, that in mentioning a coup and mentioning corruption, etc. My understanding is that the uncle was close to the Chinese, and there's of course a lot of cross-border economic activity in China, with China, and these latest reports from South Korean intelligence say that the disputes that the uncle was supposed to mediate that he failed to do, which led to his death, were related to coal, which of course North Korea exports to China, and other heavy industry. So is this another case of the regime shooting itself in the foot if their only sponsor, the Chinese, presumably were close to the uncle who was executed? They can't be too happy with this turn of events.
I'm sure the Chinese are displeased, but the Chinese have been displeased with North Korea repeatedly over the past 60 years. And each time, even in cases of blatant insult against China, China just grit its teeth, held its nose, and kept subsidizing North Korea out of strategic interests. So I don't think this is going to shift China's fundamental policy toward North Korea or the Korean Peninsula. Money matters, we know, in any system, in democracy and totalitarian system alike. There is rampant corruption within the North Korean system, and Uncle Chang indeed oversaw many of the nation's financial projects with China and others. So I'm speculating, but I think it's a reasonable assumption that Uncle Chang amassed a political fortune, not only political fortune, but a financial fortune for himself, and defied Kim Jong-un in some way, and that led to Kim Jong-un acting so swiftly to remove him from power.
So, but how do you explain this peculiar family dynasty's behavior in executing the uncle, who's the number two guy, who was the mentor, who supposedly behind the scenes orchestrated the ascension of the youngest brother, Kim Jong-un, over the others, and the fact that the older brother is apparently a kind of playboy and a wastrel living, I think, in Macau, gambling down there. And he was involved in all kinds of shady counterfeiting $100 bills and drug deals and all kinds of stuff. So I don't understand. I mean, maybe it's impossible to understand why it is he's not executed and the other guy is, you know.
Well, the elder brother from a different mother is basically, he's been ostracized for more than a dozen years. So he poses no real threat to Kim Jong-un in the short term or in the long term. Now, all those charges levied against Uncle Chang, leading a promiscuous life, womanizing, leading an extravagant life, depraved life, and so forth, being a drug user and so forth. Now, all those charges could, if you just switch the subject with Kim family for Uncle Chang, all those charges could apply to the founder of the North Korean state, Kim the Second, and the current leader, Kim the Third. But the important thing here is that North Korea is a cult-driven dynasty like no other. It is the world's sole communist hereditary dynasty, the most cultish, the most totalitarian system that the world has ever seen. And any semblance of challenge, any hint of a power base that is being built under the number two man, that is a serious threat to the regime, and it needs to be resolved. The sad thing is, the life of the number two man in a totalitarian system, unlike in a democracy where you have a deputy prime minister or vice president, he poses no threat to the leader. But in a totalitarian system, the number two man can only go down, and he is often viewed as a potential threat. And we see many instances in the former Soviet Union after Stalin's death, in the People's Republic of China under Mao Zedong, and in North Korea of swift removals of the number two man.
But the Korean expert in South Korea, Brian Myers, his analysis is somewhat different from yours. You refer to it as a communist state with the only communist dynasty. he likens the North Korean regime more to Imperial Japan before World War II, the emperor worship. It's more right-wing than left-wing. What do you make of that?
Well, North Korea is a hodgepodge of a lot of things. Stalinism, Confucianism, the imperial cult of Japan, obviously Stalinism. And yes, Professor Myers is one of the most astute observers of North Korea. But I think North Korea is an amalgamation of all these things. So yes, there are contradictions. North Korea is ultra-right-wing, fascist even, ultra-nationalistic, xenophobic, jingoistic state, not interested in spreading its ideology all that much beyond its borders. So in that sense, it is not, properly speaking, communist. But while appellations are important for our analysis of North Korea, I think we can agree that there are remnants of various ideological sources in the North Korean cultish leadership. And one of those is that North Korea is a hereditary, as it says, communist state. North Korea removed the word communism from its constitution a few years ago in 2009. Yet in the most important document of the state, which is the protocol, the charter to the Korean Workers' Party, that word is still there, and the Workers' Party, of course, that connotation comes from communism.
Well, just in the last minute, Sung-Yun Lee, do you think then that there will be something? You were saying that there'll be a crisis ginned up in the coming year, in January, but it will be orchestrated and limited and business as usual, and a part of this pattern of creating problems and then extorting rewards.
Right. I think we can say that Kim Jong-un is not suicidal. He may be a lot of things, but he's not suicidal. And we, of course, your listeners remember the long barrage of bluster against South Korea and the U.S. earlier this year. It lasted for over 2 months with threats of even nuclear strike against Washington and Seoul. Over the past 60 years, North Korea has engaged in literally countless provocations and deadly attacks against U.S. forces in South Korea and against ROK, South Korean troops and civilians. And not once did North Korea pay any kind of penalty. Not once was there military retaliation by South Korea and the U.S. So I think Kim Jong-un can feel relatively secure that he can get away with another controlled, limited attack to raise the stakes once again. But I doubt he would be so bold as to launch a general war, which would lead to his own demise.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sung-Yun Lee.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yun Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.